This program is provided by a trusted partner of the church and is educational, inspirational, and uplifting. It does not necessarily represent the official position of the church.
One of the important features of the Joseph Smith Papers is the new insight provided by the project's legal scholars.
Why would you drive people out in the middle of the winter? Why wouldn't you allow people to make the plans and then leave in the spring and have some a modicum of compassion? But to do otherwise would do to give up the opportunity they could seize by driving them out in this timetable.
Coming up next, Joseph Smith and the Law, Part 2, Missouri. The Mormon Channel presents the Joseph Smith Papers.
K-Jazz Television, in cooperation with the Church History Department of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, presents this weekly series highlighting the research of scholars and historians as they prepare for the publication of the Joseph Smith Papers. And now your host, Glenn Rawson.
The Mormons gathered in large numbers to northern Missouri in 1837 and 38. They came needing land. Mormon leaders discovered a way that land could be purchased for these immigrants at a relatively low cost. The program was called preemption, and the seller was the United States government.
Jeffrey N. Walker.
We often refer to it as the preemption period, and that was a period in which people could settle on ground, make improvements, and once the ground came into the market for sale, they would have the first right to buy it. And you'd buy it at a very low statutory rate, regardless of how much improvement you put on the land. And so the statutory rate during this time was a buck and a quarter an acre. And so you could take land, improve it, have it be worth a great deal more, and then buy it for a buck and a quarter and have almost instant equity.
Okay.
And I've concluded that the leaders of the church were very involved in understanding and using those sort of preemptive rights to acquire land, especially when you get into 38, when all these saints are coming from Ohio, who are coming completely destitute, needing a place to live.
When the Mormons were driven out of Jackson County and then later out of Clay County, they needed a place to gather. But none of the surrounding counties would let them in. Finally, the Missouri legislature passed a bill creating a new county especially for the Mormons. With great hopes and expectations, the Latter-day Saints gathered to Caldwell County and filed their claims to the new land.
Even before Caldwell County is created in December of 36, we have people going into Caldwell County and exercising preemptive rights. And these are what we'd call their applications, or in other words, their receipt, that they have settled on a piece of land sufficient to have a claim to it. These two, Austin Hammer and John York, two brother-in-laws who settle on land in Caldwell County in both November 26, 1836. You can see they're numbered consecutively.
Right, yeah.
The reason I selected these two of the ones that we've uncovered is you almost like to say to these boys, young boys in their 30s who have bought each 40 acres, pretty excited right next to each other, and you'd like to say to them in hindsight, perhaps, guys, you want to pick some other property. Perhaps this isn't where you really want to build your farm and your lives, because unbeknownst to these boys, they would be on land that would be now famously referred to as the site of the Hondsmill Massacre.
Oh, dear.
And these are two of the 17 boys that would be killed at that massacre in 1838.
Far west was in Caldwell County. It was the Saints' largest settlement in the area, numbering eventually about 5,000 people. Now, as more immigrants came into the area, some saw the area farther to the north in Davis County as preferred land. That eventually became Adamondiaman.
That land had not yet come into the market. It was truly where you could, what you'd perceive as homesteading. You could settle on the land and not pay anything with the hope that when it came on the market, you would then have the financial capacity to execute on your preemptive right. Some people say, well, the reason we went to Davis County is because Caldwell had filled up. And we'll give you a graphic that can show that we've looked at all the land that was taken in Caldwell County up into 1838. you can see that it's about 25% of the county is taken, maybe 20%. So we're talking about 75% was open. And so clearly the fact that they went to Davis County was not because they couldn't find any land in Caldwell. But I think the critical distinction was that it was land that was not yet in the market, and so you didn't have to pay for it at the time you got it.
Governor Lilburn Boggs' extermination order demanded that the Mormons leave the state or else. Recently discovered evidence suggests that the timing of the Mormons being driven from the state was rooted in something more than just religious and political bigotry. It was land.
It just so happens that in November of 1838 is when this land came up for sale. And so it was at that moment that the Mormons who lived in Davis County would have to pay for their ground.
Yeah.
And if they didn't pay for it within this small 2-week window that the government gave you, then they would lose their preemptive right and anyone could buy it. In fact, in the month of end of November through the month of December of 38, the immediate time the Saints were driven out and to the day that their preemptive rights lapsed, I've identified over 20,000 acres that were acquired in Davis County. Of course, none of them by Mormons.
Oh,
and
my
even
Lord.
Some of the most valuable sites, for example, Adamondayaman was all acquired by John Cravens and Satchel Woods and turned into Cravensville. And they bought that within a week to 2 weeks of the preemptive rights lapsing. And so they bought that whole city for $1.25 an acre. The land had been fully surveyed and that it was going to come up for sale on the November 12th date, the very date that the Austin King hearing starts. Ironically, the Austin King hearings will last for 2 weeks, and that is the 2-week period of time that the Mormons would have had to exercise their preemptive rights in Davis County.
After his betrayal and arrest, Joseph Smith was taken to Richmond, Missouri, for a preliminary hearing before Judge Austin A. King. The principal charge brought against him came from the burning of a store owned by a non-Mormon named Jacob Stallings. On the basis of testimony by disaffected Mormons Samson Avard and George M. Hinkle, claiming that Joseph led that attack, Joseph was sent to Liberty Jail.
Gordon A. Madsen.
The Avard testimony says there Joseph was at Adamondayaman giving directions about things in general connected with the war. That's a pretty ambiguous statement. Colonel Hinkle, in turn, said in his time to testify, neither of the Mr. Smiths seemed to have any command as officers in the field, but seemed to give general directions. Then later, lower down, the following are the named defendants in the last expeditions to Davies County: Joseph Smith Jr., Hiram Smith, Lyman White, Parley Pratt, and others. But you see, he says Davies County. Certainly Joseph was there, just as Avard said he was at Adamondayaman, but that by way of transit to Gallatin down the river rather than directly across the prairie where there was no road was something like 9 or more miles. So Joseph is 9 miles away
from the center of action
from
in Gallatin.
Where the incident actually occurs at Gallatin.
And that was the burning of the store.
That's the burning of the store.
Okay, so in other words then, he's not even on site. He can't be giving orders on site.
Exactly. If one were to say beyond a reasonable doubt you must prove complicity, and that's a sum total of the evidence of Joseph's involvement with this, the only incident that purports to be treasonous.
Which is the burning of the store.
The burning of the Stallings store, where there were no guns fired, there was no act of warfare, and Joseph wasn't present. To have this indirect reference that he, back in Andiamon, was calling the shots, that's a far cry from proving guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. If I were the defense attorney in that case, I'd have a heyday with Avard and Hinkle.
When the Stallings store was burned then, Joseph Smith was not there, nor was he in command of those who did. Nevertheless, Joseph was charged with the crime and sent to jail at Liberty. Moreover, for his alleged involvement in that incident, he was charged with treason.
That event could maybe be called insurrection or riot. theft, arson, burglary, if it happened in the night. All of those charges could be brought. Joseph and Hiram and Sidney were all not present at the Stallings store charge. And the treason, the crime of treason, is a very narrowly defined crime. It appears in our United States Constitution. Now, why? It's the only crime that appears in the Constitution and is defined there. And it says it must be an overt act of warfare against the nation, witnessed by two independent witnesses to the same act. Open act of warfare. Now, what happened at Stallings' store? The place is deserted. There was no warfare. Nobody fired a gun. Nobody threatened anyone else with a weapon. There was no fighting. There was no war. So to call it treason is a complete stretch. The next objection to his finding treason in this fact situation is that inflammatory language was the primary reason for charging Joseph and Sidney, because some witnesses said they heard Joseph say that he would be a modern-day Muhammad, and if he would strike with the sword of the truth, and if that was not accepted, it would be the sword of fire, or similar language. That language he uttered in Caldwell County, not Davies County. So if he's going to be charged, he should have been charged with Sidney in Caldwell rather than with the others in Davies. But he's charged in Davies County. And even under the British system, with the broad swath, inflammatory words alone was not sufficient to make out treason. And then finally, it can only be committed, treason is committed against nations, not states.
Based on the documents of the time then, Joseph Smith was sent to Liberty Jail for an act he did not commit and charged with a crime he could not commit. Why?
So, yeah. It is an amazing thing that Austin King comes up with this invention to charge him with treason. Now, why? I think the answer lies in the fact that treason and murder are the only two crimes in Missouri at the time for which there is no bail allowed. One cannot post a bail to get his freedom while he's awaiting trial. He is stuck in jail. So who gets put in jail? The primary leaders of the Mormon Church. Joseph, Sidney, Hiram, First Presidency. But back to the issue, therefore, of taking hostages. And that's what Judge King was doing. Because they were non-bailable, he was holding these prisoners in jail while the saints moved out of the state. And the word was therefore given. Judge Turnham, who was the district judge in Caldwell County, Turnham tells the inmates in the prison, according to Hiram's own affidavit given in a later hearing, he also told us that the governor was now ashamed enough of the whole transaction and would be glad to set us at liberty if he dared do it. But, he said, you need not be concerned, for the governor has laid a plan for your release. Now, people can say, well, Hiram is misremembering or not clearly remembering, and Turnham is trying to mollify them or whatever. But Emma, who had been to the prison, Liberty Jail, twice, following her second visit, said, Sheriff Samuel Hadley, who was in charge of the jail, Tillery was the name of the actual jailer, but he was deputy sheriff, Hadley the sheriff. Hadley tells Emma, quote, All the authorities are waiting for you to get out of the state, and the prisoners will be let out. There is no reason for detaining them other than the unconscionable orders given. And you could say, well, again, somebody just trying to be polite, mollifying to Emma to say, yeah, keep your hopes up or whatever. But when you start getting accounts from just run-of-the-mill Mormons who say, for example, Daniel Stilwell Thomas remembered Joseph Smith sending word to the Far West Saints from Liberty Jail that there would be no chance for his deliverance until we were all out of the state. That isn't, you know, some happenstantial thing. That's a general public knowledge matter. All right. Another quote from Joseph Holbrook, Chandler Holbrook's brother. Our enemies were determined to hold them as hostages until the church left the state, so that every exertion was made in the dead of winter to remove as quickly as possible. That explains why the winter departure. That explains the hostage theory.
The hearing in Richmond in November of 1838 was only a preliminary hearing. No formal indictments were returned. For that, they would need to attend a grand jury hearing in Gallatin in Davis County. It took nearly 5 months for that hearing to be convened. It came on April the 10th, 1839, and it only lasted 2 days.
Why wasn't it a more comprehensive hearing? Because as we've looked at it more carefully, one cannot help but conclude that no one was on the legal end seriously contemplating that they were going to take this to trial. There's a couple critical claims in the case, the burning of a store, imposition on an official, but the burning of a store was of a guy named Peniston. He was one of the main people that said this is what they really did wrong to us. But just so happens the foreman of the jury is his brother. And another member of the jury is his father. Well, how could you have a fair jury when you have two of the jurors be interested parties? And then it gets a little more disconcerting when you realize that three other members of this jury in Gallatin were actual people in the mob at Hahn's Mill. Well, so clearly I think up front we realize that the grand jury composition itself was legally, even in their time, flawed, inappropriate.
The grand jury returned indictments against 41 people. Six of them, including Joseph Smith, were indeed charged with treason. They were ordered to stand trial in Columbia, Boone County. But those indictments had some notable irregularities.
Because the very indictments themselves, as we'll show on the electronic copies we have blanks left in them. Why would they have blanks? They left the blanks for the date of the events that were supposed to be the events that were the resulting treasonous action. They never pin it down. They never put them in. They sent the indictments with the blanks in them. So then you have to think, well, why? Because once it would get tried, wouldn't even a first-year lawyer come up to say, Your Honor, it appears these indictments are fundamentally flawed. They don't even list the dates in which, how am I to prepare to defend what my clients were doing on those dates? You haven't even given us the dates of the events you're claiming they did the wrongful acts. Well, maybe the explanation would be no one ever thought it was going to get tried. It wasn't about trying the boys. It was about using them as hostages to assure the rest of the saints left the state. There is a move to change venue. And we could spend time talking about it, but in the end, it's granted. It's granted on a kind of bizarre basis. It's granted on the basis that the judge at this grand jury hearing is a guy named Birch. Birch just so happens to have been the prosecuting attorney at the Austin King hearing. That's why he didn't need a lot of time. He was the prosecuting attorney, which resulted in the imprisonment into liberty. And even the law in those days precluded a lawyer who had been interested in the case already to sit as judge on it. Mm-hmm. And so on that basis, Judge Birch had no other choice but to move the venue, and he moved it down to Boone County, about 100 miles away.
So Joseph Smith and the other prisoners escape. They go to Illinois. Now, not long after that, surprisingly, Thomas Reynolds, the prosecutor, has all the charges against the fugitive Mormons dismissed.
Prisoners are released April 16, 1839. July the 19th, Boone County gets the indictments from Davies County, now has jurisdiction. August the 5th of 1840, after several continuances, postponements of the case, the Boone County prosecutor moves to dismiss all of the indictments, particularly including the treason indictment. And there's a page from the docket of the court showing the treason case, showing that the prosecutor moved their dismissal. So there are no indictments, none, outstanding against Mormons as of August the 5th of 1840. Now, on the 15th of September 1840, Governor Boggs sends a petition for extradition of Joseph Smith to Governor Carlin of Illinois for treason. He doesn't mention any of the other offenses, just treason. He sends it to him, and on November the 16th, just 2 months later, Boggs is out of office. He is replaced by Thomas Reynolds. I should have mentioned that the district circuit judge who signed the docket that issued the orders dismissing them all was Thomas Reynolds, the man who succeeded Boggs as governor. He resigned his judgeship right after this particular term of court so he could run for governor. And 2 months later, he's elected.
Even though the charges against the Mormons had been dismissed in the county holding jurisdiction, namely Boone County, Davies County continued to act as though the indictments were valid. They called the case for prosecution, even though Joseph Smith and the other prisoners had long since left the state. Now, why?
He shows, so they proceed against the bail of all of the named defendants to, in fact, forfeit their bail and get judgments against them on file in Davies County.
Explain what that means when they proceeded against their bail. Exactly what does that mean in layman's terms?
When you post a bail, you sign a document which was called a recognizance, promising to appear at the day of trial.
Okay.
Then you have two securities, they call them then. We call them sureties now. And it usually means two citizens of the area who were property owners. And if the bail, for example, is set at $100 or $500, the bond or recognizance and bail bond has to be twice that amount. So $500 bail, $1,000 recognizance and bail bond.
Okay.
Then if you don't appear on the day of trial, they forfeit the bail and proceed against the real property. They get a judgment and proceed against whatever they can find owned by that person in the county.
Okay.
Interestingly, all of these forfeitures were not against the securities, but only against the named defendant. Further, interestingly, it's a real question in my mind, at least, how one can be in contempt of court for failing to appear for my trial when I'm under an order from the chief executive of the state to get out of your state.
Boggs' extermination order,
yeah.
Driving them out.
Sure. How am I in contempt when you've ordered me out? But that notwithstanding, they go through this charade, even though we don't have any jurisdiction, because it's all over there in Boone County. And in the previous segment, I showed you the letter that Judge Birch himself wrote saying, we don't have jurisdiction. It's gone to Boone.
And that was in Davies County.
And that
okay.
was in Davies. He was the Davies County Circuit Judge. So the point being, they do this charade, I believe, so that there are judgments outstanding against these Mormons now out of state, so that should any of them come back to Davies County saying, I've got some land here that you have preempted me out of, and they say, we have a little judgment against you, and we'll throw you in debtor's prison if you show your head.
While Davis County continued to prosecute charges against Joseph that had been dropped, Thomas Reynolds, now Governor Reynolds, sought to extradite Joseph from Illinois on the basis of those same dismissed charges.
He takes office November the 16th. Joseph leaves Nauvoo with Sidney Rigdon Elias Higbee for Washington, D.C., with petitions for redress for the Saints to recover the lost property that had been taken from them by virtue of their being expelled from the state pursuant to the extermination order. Now, between September of 40 through June of 41, Governor Carlin of Illinois has received the Boggs petition and issued a warrant for Joseph's arrest, and that warrant is sent back to him as being unable to find. And is returned to Carlin. Carlin hadn't sent it back to Boggs. He still has it. But Governor Reynolds, the new governor, writes to Carlin saying, please have that extradition warrant served on Joseph Smith. And here is Reynolds, who very well knows there's no treason indictment still outstanding on which to base that petition, is still asking to have it served on Joseph.
It's interesting, when Joseph Smith went to Washington to appeal the Saints' cause for their treatment in Missouri, the Illinois congressman who introduced Joseph to President Martin Van Buren was John Reynolds, Governor Thomas Reynolds' brother, the same man who was trying to manipulate the law to have Joseph return to Missouri.
I don't know why, and I can't. There are only two alternatives to me. One is that he has either forgotten that he dismissed the treason indictment as judge, or that he hopes neither Governor Carlin or any Mormons in Illinois know of that dismissal, and we still want him back. Why do we want him back? To try him for treason? No, we want him back to take his life. That's my opinion. And that was Joseph's opinion. And Joseph repeatedly said to Carlin, to Ford, to everybody else who came with him with these various petitions, if I go back to Missouri, my life is over. They want my blood.
Officials of the state of Missouri repeatedly attempted to extradite Joseph. And when those efforts failed, they even tried to kidnap him. These extra-legal efforts will be discussed later when we return with Joseph Smith and the Law, Part 3, Extradition. But first, next week, Joseph Smith and Nauvoo, the founding of the City Beautiful. I'm Glenn Rossum. Thanks for joining us.
You've been listening to the Joseph Smith Papers here on the Mormon Channel.